So I'm sort of technically challenged today. I didn't have my speech printed out, so I'm working off of two screens. Bear with me. So it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming. I know there's a lot of competing sessions today, and I feel sort of intimidated that you actually chose this one. So I appreciate you coming. I'm going to talk about this slide, and it's going to stay up there for most of my presentation. I'm going to talk about it indirectly in terms of legislation, policy, and constitutional rights and things like that. I'm not a lawyer, nor am I a doctor. I have a lot of OJT, 35 years of it, a lot of on-the-job experience. And hopefully this will be fun for me as well as you. I think from my perspective, you know, as I look at why things are the way they are, in this country and why there are such disparate health status conditions and economic conditions, I realize that unless rights are specifically legislated, they are not guaranteed. If they're not specifically mentioned, and I mean at real levels of legal specificity in the law or in a constitution, they cannot presume to exist. Even the issue of voting has been a progressive legalistic discussion where initially only men who owned land could vote, and later there were provisions that needed to be made against taxing people at voting polls, and then people of color were added separately and women were added separately to the voting. And even today we hear daily charges of attempts to deny people they're what we consider to be the right to vote, but it's not specifically legislated. So if we're looking at health or health care, if we don't specifically legislate those things, access, personal health, they do not exist as an opportunity on an equal basis in the country. We talk in the Constitution about the right to life in several places. However, in this country, people who are uninsured die at greater rates than the insured, and people of color die at greater rates, and people who are poor die at greater rates. They have an unequal access to the right to life, or an unequal ability to attain life or maintain life. And I think, in my perspective, that's a violation of our Constitution. Because of these, the lack of specificity in people's rights to health, we have created what we all sort of accept as okay in terms of safety net programs. Everybody's going to be okay because we have a safety net. I find the fact that we have a safety net in America unconscionable. That not everyone, if everyone were in the safety net, no one would be in the safety net. Essentially. And there are other places for whom safety net programs are just a part of life. Everybody gets them. There are countries where everybody gets child care regardless of their income. Everybody gets child support regardless of their income. Everybody's entitled to a higher education at little or no cost. And for us, we've assumed this perspective that the marketplace is where every issue, every condition that affects people in this country will be determined by the market. And that requires people to have means. In order to access market, people have to have resources. So, as in the health insurance industry, only those people who have means can have access to health care. That again, then denying them the right to life in many cases. And it's funny how there are provisions in our Constitution that require certain protections or give certain protections to certain classes of people. For instance, criminals are given fair and equal treatment under the law. They're protected from cruel and unusual punishment. And the interpretation of that in the 16th Amendment, that prisoners cannot be subject to cruel and unusual punishment, affords them the right to food, shelter, and health care. So prisoners have the right to food, shelter, and health care, but not the general population. In fact, who was it that went to Alcatraz yesterday? Was that you, Roxanne?
It was Linda.
It was Linda. I went to Alcatraz yesterday. There's a sign that says, "You're a prisoner. You have the right to food, shelter, and health care. For everything else, you're pretty much on your own." So I think that that's an amazing thing to me, that that provision is constitutional. It's not actually in our Constitution. So there are a lot of things that limit our access to health care beyond means. Our ability to make choices in the healthcare system, and I feel like I'm preaching to the choir, so I'm trying to like skip around here to fit the group, because I know you all know most of this stuff. But our ability to make choices in healthcare is often based on the information provided by us by the people who own the resources that make money from those decisions. And I find that also unconscionable. In other words, private physicians who own MRIs are 70% more likely to refer for an MRI than physicians who don't own MRIs, in that study done in Texas a few years ago. So our choices are limited in the marketplace, which doesn't make it a free and open marketplace. Insurance buffers the market in terms of choice, since most of the cost still, or some of the cost of healthcare, doesn't come directly out of your pocket. You're not impacted by the cost of healthcare, and your price goes up for your insurance, but you have no decision on which what that price is or what the payments are for the services you receive. All of these things inhibit our ability to be healthy and access the market in appropriate ways. So the bottom line on this is we have to have then, as a basic premise, that health care is a right, and that allows for a better equalization of the service delivery system. Even in ACA, the issue was not whether that was being disputed was not whether or not health care was a human right, but whether or not the federal government could force people to pay to receive health care. So even that perspective, ACA does not create an environment where healthcare is a human right. And secondly, as you know, and there's been other, and there will be other sessions during this session or this conference, having healthcare as a human right does not ensure health. And I believe that one of the reasons that oftentimes education, social programs, and public health programs are threatened by Congress, it's because the private marketplace, corporations, haven't figured out how to profit from those effectively. So you never hear about prisons being cut. You never hear about the military being cut, or very often. You never hear about other diversions of public money to private interests being cut. But in those places where the private sector hasn't figured out how to profit from tax dollars, those are the ones that are threatened. Public school education is threatened, higher education is threatened, social programs are threatened, and public health is often on the chopping block. And I think if you'll see after this election, depending on the outcome, that the public health trust fund will be threatened, potentially, as a means of saving tax dollars. But we're not hearing a lot about prisons or the military being cut. So if health is a right, we have to figure out ways to equalize for the marketplace. We have to figure out ways to make healthy food as inexpensive as food that's not good for you. That will require public subsidies, either through cash payments to people or through subsidies of corporations that grow food, whether they're for-profit or co-ops or whatever. There are a few financial incentives for a healthy environment. So we use our tax dollars to subsidize programs that are unhealthy, or corporations that are unhealthy for our environment, but we still haven't figured out the long-term investment in creating a healthy environment, or, for that fact, a safe environment. And this tenor of the social programs, the safety net, the whole safety net concept is a punitive concept, in that people who are in the safety net often have to do things that threaten their stability to come out of the safety net. So if you get a job, you may lose your child care support. You may lose SNAP. You may lose housing subsidy. You may lose these things. And we've created an environment where we vilify people who spend long periods of time in the safety net, and yet we punish them for leaving the safety net. These kinds of things, I believe, need legislation. The right to childcare, the right to food and good food, the right to housing needs to be stipulated in order for us to have a healthy society. In summary of this part of my presentation, obviously you can tell I'm not a constitutional laureate of any form, but I have very strong feelings about how we leave people behind, how we punish people, and how that affects their health. I'm going to try to segue into how we try at HMS in our Center for Health Innovation and our programs, how we try to make up for these discrepancies and these disparities in health policy, and how we try to legislate workarounds, essentially, so that people can have a better life and be more healthy and access the healthcare system better. Many of you may have seen pyramids, you know, like this. This is sort of our version of it at HMS. I don't like the term social determinants of health. I think that is sort of a safety net perspective as well. It's like when you look at these pyramids, on the bottom layer it always says "and social determinants of health," but all the work happens above it. And I think we need to restructure our social policy, period. And until we do, there are always going to be social determinants of poor health or bad health outcomes. It's not just helping people access housing or food or other health care. It's changing the way we look at social determinants to create a better social infrastructure for everyone in the country. And so that's how we try to think about it. So while we have community health workers who work full-time in helping people access various support systems that they need that exist publicly, we're also trying to work nationally and in other places on creating a better social environment, because that often gets left behind. We look at primary care as a broad range of services, from prevention through care management and patient management. In historical definitions of primary care, treatment and diagnosis are the basic definition. Primary care is, you know, the first place people enter the healthcare system for diagnosis and treatment. We think that because prevention, from a public health perspective or a population perspective, has been left out of the system from the standpoint of integration into the delivery system, that there haven't been sufficient resources to do good population health and outreach and create better environments. And that prevention needs to be built into the payment system. We're going down a private insurance model. We're going down privatization of pathways to privatize Medicaid and Medicare. Those privatization processes have to finance then prevention, and we're looking at ways to do that. So we look at these four core services now, instead of three in primary care, looking at medical, dental, behavioral health, and family support as core primary care services. And that each of those primary care service venues provide the opportunity for prevention, diagnosis, treatment, and management. And using community health workers and other unlicensed folks to provide family support services as well as licensed folk, we often get in trouble when we say that that community health workers do diagnosis and treatment. But in fact, they do. And they do it well, and they do it on non-clinical measures, and they do it on social measures, and they support the diagnosis and treatment process through early entry into the system. We're looking at how we can better utilize for our patient population, vertical parts of the healthcare system, the more expensive parts of the healthcare system, through care management programs. And we're working on workforce training. When we designed our family support program, we put in the orientation for our community health workers a career track. And we pay for a career track. We have a higher ed career track. We have a sort of a business management career track. And then a healthcare track. And promotoras get to choose from one track or another, or multiple tracks, and they achieve certain milestones of education or training, they get financial increases. But also what we're trying to do is prepare people for other work in the community. We feel like our job is to create a healthier community by providing a better workforce for the community. So we do training on Word and Excel and PowerPoint and office management. And if folks can get a job in another environment, we encourage that. Because not only have we provided a better workforce, but we provided a workforce who is now better educated about diabetes and hypertension and has taken training classes and cooking and has done grocery store tours with our patients to learn how to read labels on food. And so that goes home with our employees as well as our patients. And so we're trying to create this better environment on a more holistic way to mitigate for some of the deficits and policy and legislation around healthcare. And so our model is basically this structurally, that within our patient population, which is actually a little skewed in terms of the bell-shaped curve, and we have people in very excellent health in our population, we have people that are very sick. And that the cost for care increases as you go right on the population curve. And so we need to have intentional programs that reflect the actual status of our population. We have contracts now with Medicaid managed care companies to take their most expensive patients regardless of health condition. So whether they're war veterans who are schizophrenic and living in cars outside of their parents' house because they're disruptive into the family and they require more intensive mental health support, we're working with those with community health workers, getting them into better systems of support. People that are frequent ER utilizers who don't have primary care base, we're working with those. And then the studies that we've shown with these 40 patients, that we literally save millions and millions of dollars every year in cost while providing a better, more healthy environment for those people who have the highest costs. And so our goal, most traditional community health worker programs happen at the middle of this curve. People enter the healthcare system through a clinic or through some other social service. They go to a community health worker when they're early diagnosed with hypertension or diabetes or asthma or early in pregnancy, and they're managed when they're healthy, or at least not expensive. And so we provide education, we have a curriculum, one-on-one counseling at the community health worker to try to keep people from the right side of the curve. And we use those conditions, both at the far right end and the middle, to inform our outreach efforts and our public health primary prevention support. And then the question is, how do you pay for it? Well, the answer is it's really hard because legislation and policy doesn't support a rational approach to supporting people in the healthcare system. So, you know, we have CDC grants to work on these things, but we also have created in our Medicaid MCOs contracts to manage people on a per member per month basis, those 40 expensive people, and we use the excess revenues from that venture to finance our public health efforts in the community, our health fairs and our advertising, our radio spots and our billboards and other community outreach. But it's a challenge. But there's such a crying need. There's such a crying need for this in the country right now. It's amazing. Last year, I shifted from CEO of the health services side of our Hidalgo Medical Services to creating the Center for Health Innovation. And so we don't at the center provide any direct service delivery. But a year ago, now we had about a $750,000 budget and five staff people, and now just, you know, 12 months later, it's a $4.5 million program with 17 staff people working in 22 states to help people figure out how to do this better. The need is so huge, and it's from a lack of legislative environment or legal environment that supports good health. So The challenges are amazing. The things we have to do to mitigate for the fact that we have no rational healthcare system, that the costs are incredibly high and people are increasingly not covered. Hopefully that changes over the next couple years. It could go away. The ability to get insurance could go away soon. So I'm going to turn it over to Roxanne, who's going to talk a little bit more about population-specific issues around health as a human right. I hope this made sense. I try to go from a broader view of constitutional rights and legislative rights to more specific impact on delivery systems and how we have to adjust our delivery systems to make up for these issues. I hope that makes sense. And hopefully it'll even make more sense as we go through the rest of the presentation. Thank you.